Support of WAER's Syracuse Speaks program is made possible thanks to the St. Mary Ann Cope Shrine and Museum's Empathy in Action Initiative, making relevant the values of Mary Ann and her sisters to today's issues and challenges. Empathy in Action is working with our local companies and service organizations to help incorporate compassion and unity into our day-to-day lives and shape a kinder community.
I'm pleased to report that your city is standing strong. We have faced the blows of the pandemic, and while the threat of COVID-19 is not over, we have withstood the challenge at every stage.
Welcome to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Chris Bolt.
And I'm Katie Zwokowski. Syracuse has a lot on its to-do list in the new year. Primarily, the city is trying to find ways to fiscally and physically recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. But they're also working on police reform, long-standing economic development initiatives, and anticipating progress on the I-81 project.
We're joined today by Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh, who recently delivered his State of the City address with the city in a state none of us could have ever imagined a year ago. The mayor enters the final year of his first term with pandemic impacts on the economy, many city residents, local businesses, and the city's ability to provide services.
But that doesn't mean there isn't a vision for the future. Improvement of city services, neighborhood development, and smart city investments are all being set as goals for the coming year. And today we'll go deeper into that vision for Syracuse in 2021. Mayor Walsh, thanks for joining us today on Syracuse Speaks.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we want to start by taking stock of the past year as we're beginning this new one. The COVID-19 pandemic, as we mentioned, has totally reshaped the city and presented new problems. But you've often said that there's also silver linings and opportunities within this. Can you tell us what are those opportunities that you talk about?
Sure. Well, I pride myself on being an eternal optimist. But even for me, 2020 challenged that more than I ever thought it could. But as I sit here in 2021, looking forward and looking back, I continue to be optimistic. Again, 2020 was extremely difficult. We saw just an incredible loss of life. We saw significant social unrest, things that are going to be with us for a long time. But when I look before what was happening before the pandemic in this community, you know, by all accounts, all things were headed in the right direction. All the metrics that we track, from population growth to job growth to crime to vacant property data, all of those were indicating that we were headed in the right direction. And as I look now, as we hopefully are coming out of the pandemic, all of the ingredients that led to those successes are still in place. And in spite of the pandemic, we were able to move the ball forward on virtually all of our priorities in 2020, not as fast as we would have liked because, again, there were significant distractions, but we kept things moving. So I continue to be optimistic, and there's a lot to look forward to in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, the speed of it definitely was impacted by COVID, but would you say slowing things down gave you the opportunity to maybe look more critically at some of the developments you're trying to make?
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at, from my perspective, those two major issues that were somewhat unexpected going into 2020. Certainly the pandemic was completely unexpected, but the civil and social unrest that really sparked from the murder of George Floyd, but obviously was something that's been with us for a long time and will continue to be. It did force me and force us to focus on some of the underlying conditions. I think both of those situations shine light on problems that have been ailing our community and our society for a long time. When you look at how the pandemic has impacted different communities, as is the case with many other health challenges, it has disproportionately impacted communities of color and other marginalized communities. When you look at the unrest that happened from Mr. Floyd's murder, again, these are things that have been plaguing communities of color for a long time, the issue of police community relations and police brutality. And it just brought it into a light that many that have the privilege of not seeing it every day finally saw it. Mm-hmm. So in those ways, It certainly helped me to focus on those underlying conditions that have led to a lot of what ails us as a community, to make sure that as we're pushing forward, as we're moving that progress forward, we're making up for and accounting for those issues that that again have contributed to a lot of the problems that we face today.
On a personal note, I mean, what has it been like leading the city? You know, the pandemic hit. No one knew how long it would last. Some thought, you know, a month or two we'll be through this. Now it's a year later and we're still wrestling with it. As you mentioned, the police protests, police, you know, conduct protests, et cetera, from the George Floyd killing. It's not exactly what you signed on for, but it is what you signed on for. Like, how did you sort of, on a personal note, find the right leadership tone to take through disaster, you know, mitigation,
right,
plus some of the positive changes that, you know, we're still dealing with that you just were talking about?
Yeah, I certainly tried to tell myself this is what I signed up for, if nothing else, to make myself feel better. But again, if I'm being honest with myself, no one could have anticipated what we saw over the past year. That said, you know, like everyone else, it's impacted everyone. And so you've had to adapt to it both in your personal and professional life. And I'm no different. From a leadership perspective, I pride myself on being an adaptive leader, meaning that in some cases, the type of leadership that's needed is to lead from the front and to be front and center, and I'm comfortable with that. And sometimes it's playing a more supportive role, and I'm comfortable with that. And this year, more than any, I've had to adjust and adapt based on those circumstances. The pandemic is an example. On the local front, fighting the pandemic starts with the local health department. The local health department is at Onondaga County. So, you know, early on when people were seeing the county executive getting up, doing his daily briefings, the governor doing his daily briefings, who, of course, oversees the state health department, people were saying, well, why aren't you doing daily briefings? And I said, because the important information is coming from the health departments. I also realized that there was a lot of other things that needed to get done, mm-hmm. you know, ensuring that we were responding in an equitable manner, that we were taking care of our most vulnerable populations. So I tried to adapt and be supportive and fill in the gaps where I could. And I think I was successful in doing that.
Let's try to put ourselves in a where are we on some of the kind of signature projects of your administration. Certainly one that's gotten a lot of attention, maybe went through a little bit of a pause, is Syracuse Surge. Where are we in Syracuse Surge and the various projects that are there?
So just as a reminder, the way we define Syracuse Surge is that it's our strategy for inclusive growth in the new economy. So it's not one project. It's really a strategy with a number of projects intended to advance that strategy. The foundational project for Syracuse Surge was the investment in our smart streetlight network, which we now have in place. So that is complete and something that is already saving money, saving energy, and creating some tech opportunities for us. A number of the other signature projects, the STEAM school. We were successful in early 2020 in securing state funding for the STEAM school. Again, the pandemic, I think, slowed some of our progress, but ultimately we've been able to work out most of the details with the county and the school district, and we expect to get that project underway this year. There is, on the private sector side, we were able to sell our vision of Syracuse Surge to JMA Wireless, one of the most successful growing tech companies in the region. And when they looked to where they wanted to invest in a high-tech manufacturing facility, they invested on the south side in what we call the South Side Campus for the New Economy. So that project, it's underway right now. There's construction happening. So those projects are all moving forward, again, at different rates. But we have been able to make significant progress this year. We've gotten significant investment from global partners like JPMorgan Chase, like Microsoft, like Verizon, most recently AT&T, both of whom are bringing 5G wireless technology here. So for it's really just continuing that progress. One of the priorities going into this year is on the transportation front. We're anxious to make some real progress on bus rapid transit, and we think some of those technology investments are going to help us with that. And also related to technology, we've taken some small steps towards bridging the digital divide, but I think in light of what we've seen in the pandemic, the urgency for bridging that faster has certainly increased. So that's what we're going to prioritize this year as well.
I mean, given that the pandemic and its economic impacts are still with us, even though in some measures are better, what else can we do to have equitable growth, to get to a problem that, you know, Syracuse has made strides on but still has, which is that the economy doesn't benefit everybody?
It's about identifying those barriers to equitable growth and trying to remove them or break them down. So, you know, on the topic of poverty, and this is something we've all talked about, and I know you all have talked about quite a bit. You know, we did some real research and analysis to identify what some of those primary barriers were to opportunity. I mentioned the digital divide. That's a significant one for a number of communities in our city. Transportation. That's why when I talk about bus rapid transit, when I talk about the importance of pedestrian infrastructure, why I want to create a citywide municipal sidewalk program, it's because many people in our city don't have access to a personal vehicle. So it's, again, identifying those barriers. Education, a significant one, although, you know, we're making very good progress with the school district. They just announced a graduation rate of 70.7%, the highest it's been under the current state reporting system. So it's identifying those and it's breaking them down. Another one that is related to economic opportunity is housing stability. It's a lot harder to hold down a job when you're moving regularly, and a significant portion of our population is moving at least one time per year, and that can be very disruptive on families. So, you know, we launched over the past couple of years an eviction prevention program that has helped to keep people in their houses. We launched a new city service that we are delivering now in the financial empowerment centers and helping people with financial counseling and reducing debt. So again, it's just identifying those barriers, breaking them down, and then also on the workforce development side, working with those employers who are helping to get projects done like JMA and saying, what are your needs from a workforce front and how can we train our existing workforce and our residents to fill those needs? And we're doing that increasingly with a lot of our local employers.
Syracuse Surge is not just one project, but a larger initiative, multiple development projects. With development, especially tech development, often comes gentrification. Is obviously, as you just explained, you're looking at pathways for people to enter this new tech economy and sector. But what about keeping them in their communities and the integrity of their communities? Do you have an active plan to combat that incoming problem?
Absolutely. So, you know, again, just on the question of inclusivity as it relates to specific sectors, we know traditionally the technology sector, high tech sector, has been exclusive, and that's actually why JPMorgan Chase invested in our community. There were 250 cities that applied for their Advancing Cities grant. Syracuse was one of five, and the two biggest reasons were, that they told us were, number one, we as a community in the private sector, the public sector, were aligned and working together. But also that we had a specific focus on being inclusive and making sure that we are creating those pathways for people that traditionally have been left behind by the tech sector. So we are being very intentional in, again, connecting those people to opportunities. To your question, Katie, about gentrification, with that investment, oftentimes does come gentrification. And that's a real concern of ours and something where, again, we want to differentiate ourselves in how we accommodate new investment and new growth in a way that benefits people. One of the most significant both opportunities but also risks as it relates to gentrification is the I-81 Viaduct project. I've been a big proponent of the community grid that will result in the viaduct being removed and a lot of new real estate being available for investment. If left to its own devices, the market would likely result in gentrification. We're trying to get out ahead of that. We were successful in securing a $1 million grant just recently, specifically to focus on ensuring that those that live within the shadow of the viaduct not only aren't hurt by any future investments, but actually benefit from them. So we're trying to use the time that we have between now and when these projects really take root to make sure that the planning and the processes are in place, again, not only to avoid gentrification, but to really to help lift people up that are there right now.
Yeah, and that's a great segue into I-81, which has made quite a few headlines recently with everyone from the federal to state to local level making moves on it or talking about it, discussing the project. And equity is a huge part of that, especially given the history of what I-81 did to specifically the 15th Ward when it was built. It's not always as simple as just saying you're going to hire local people or saying you're going to keep people in their homes. There's a lot of kind of bureaucratic barriers to that. Mm-hmm. So how is the city kind of trying to either work around or break through those bureaucratic barriers to making sure you're able to do what you're wanting to do?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one of the things that I've had to learn in some cases the hard way over the past 3 years, is that it's one thing to have good intent and good intentions, but it's another thing to actually make sure that you're creating the systems changes that are allowing you to get to that outcome. And 81's a perfect example of that. So I believe strongly that the community grid option is the right option. I feel very encouraged by the fact that not only has it been identified as the preferred alternative from the state, but we now have a federal administration in the Biden-Harris administration, and specifically with the new transportation secretary, former mayor of South Bend, Pete Buttigieg, that they understand both the opportunity there, but also the legacy of federal infrastructure projects and how they have disproportionately impact Black and brown communities and other marginalized communities. That was what got me so excited when shortly after Mayor Buttigieg was nominated, as he explicitly acknowledged the racist legacy of federal infrastructure and specifically transportation projects. And that was very encouraging to me. But to your question, now the key is, okay, we acknowledge it. We have good intentions to address it. How do you put the policies in place to ensure that it happens? One of those areas that we are going to be anxious to work with the federal government on is changing some of the federal laws to create more opportunities for local people to work on the project. There was some good measures put in place during the Obama administration that were removed during the Trump administration that we want to get put back in place, that gives us some more flexibility to be able to do that for federally funded transportation projects. So that's what we're in the process right now of doing, is looking at the bureaucracy, at the process, identifying those barriers and trying to remove them.
Let me switch gears just slightly about something you brought up earlier, is police reform. Needless to say, it was something that was in process before the actions and the protests and the speaking out over this summer. Much more attention worldwide, nationwide, and in the city has been put to it. And in a similar way, as you're mentioning about the big table, lots of people have talked about this, and there's been meetings and all sorts of things. What's your sense of what's gotten done so far that you can say, well, this is something, yes, that really makes it different than policing was, a year, 2 years ago?
Yeah, well, you know, I've said often that I'm very proud of the work that we've done and the progress that we've made on police reform, and also that I believe that it's more than has been done in recent memory. However, I will also be quick to remind myself and to remind others that it's not enough. There's a lot more to be done, and the one thing that I learned sometimes the hard way over the summer was that that we weren't moving fast enough. And so it has created a sense of urgency for me and in the administration that I think will help to continue to accelerate that change. But when you look at just between now and when I came into office in 2018, there's a few things that we did that I think have helped to put us in a better position. One started with the hiring of Chief Buckner. We spent nearly a year with the leadership of Deputy Mayor Owens going around the community, having public meetings, hearing a lot of the painful, tragic stories that we heard all across the country over the past year in gymnasiums and community centers that helped to inform our decision-making process. Once Chief Buckner came on board, he prided himself on being a reform chief. He had specific plans right when he walked through the door that he started on. There's a lot of discussion about police accountability, police discipline. Chief Buckner is a disciplinarian. Any of the officers will tell you that. And he brought a whole other level to police discipline and accountability. He identified that our internal affairs office was under-resourced. He identified the barrier that we had in place by locating our internal affairs office in the public safety building, which in itself is a form of intimidation. That wasn't even on my radar, and he quickly identified that problem, moved it out where it's now over in City Hall Commons on the same floor as the Citizens Review Board, which we see as an important partner.
Citizens Review Board still is fairly toothless. I mean, I know it's in some of the recommendations you've made, but
yeah,
like that does seem to be the most public-facing you know, way for there to be accountability for police misconduct that harms a citizen.
Well, I would agree that they're an absolute critical partner. I think that accountability starts in the department, and if you can do it effectively, it lessens the need for the CRB or other outside mechanisms. But there clearly is a need for that, and we need people to feel like that's a viable option. One of the other more recent changes we made since Chief Buckner has been in office is now that the CRB recommendations that are made go to the chief's office, and the chief has made a commitment to taking those recommendations into consideration before he makes a final decision on discipline. So that's another significant step. The fact that we have body cameras on all of our police officers now, over 200 of them, over 220, whereas when I took office, we only had 16. That's progress. So again, there's a number of areas where we've made progress that's visible and tangible, but I'll be the first one to tell you there's a whole lot more to do.
You mentioned that all of the community meetings that you held, and probably most notably for most people in Syracuse, was the one this past summer that went hours long and was a whole panel of city leaders. Do meetings like that make you think any differently about policing or safety as a concept, as opposed to just what we are so used to and how it's structured? I mean, has your idea of those things expanded past what it was when you came into office?
It has, yes, absolutely. And again, the 4 hours in the chambers was extremely well spent time. It was not easy or comfortable, but it was important. Before that, a significant memory is when the chief and I were in the St. Lucie's gymnasium shortly after a very prominent use of force issue. Those moments absolutely have influenced me because it puts right front and center the very personal experiences that people have had and how it's impacted their lives. But to your question, Katie, about the system of policing, I think what also comes across loud and clear in those conversations is that, again, the factors that are contributing to how the police and the community are interacting go far beyond law enforcement. And I think all too often, historically, we have looked to law enforcement to do things or to solve problems that, frankly, they have no business trying to solve and aren't equipped to solve. And I think that they're increasingly, and especially with Chief Buckner, there's an acknowledgement of that within law enforcement, specifically within SPD. So part of the process that we are undertaking now is looking at where are those opportunities where we are asking the police department to do certain things that would be better off shifting to a different partner and shifting the resources with it. So whether that's related to crisis intervention, dealing with people with mental health or substance abuse issues, some of the funding that we actually have received from the federal government since the pandemic started through the CARES Act, we recently just deployed to hire Liberty Resources that are actually going to do some co-response with SPD and also do some response on their own, some direct outreach to people with mental health and substance abuse issues on the streets, whereas if they weren't available, people likely would have been calling 911 and looking for a police response, and we know that that's not the best way.
Now, your time in office, however long it may be, how do you plan to create sustainable reform, not just something that is either easily reversible or can fade away with time or depending on budget seasons? How do you plan to create a system that can withstand for years in Syracuse and grow and flourish in a way that does make residents feel more safe?
Yeah, that's the key question. It's one that I've really wrestled with. And again, this summer really brought front and center to me. Again, there's a lot of things that I'm proud of that we've done. And when you look specifically at the issue around, you know, race and inequity, one of the first things that I did when I came into office was try to ensure that my staff reflected the diversity of the community, from Deputy Mayor Owens, Chief Buckner, Chief Mons, DPW Commissioner Robinson. We had a lot of firsts among those positions for people of color. And I think that has led to good outcomes. But what I have been spending more and more time thinking about, especially as I go into an election year, is if I were to walk out the door and my colleagues walk out with me, have we achieved any systemic long-term change, or did we simply just make some marginal improvements and then the system kind of falls back to its status quo? So what that has led us to do is really, again, to take a closer look at those systems, whether it's hiring, how we handle HR, the policies that we have in place to make sure that we make those systems changes that will lead to long-term sustainable change. But that's where the real hard work is.
Mm-hmm.
And every day that goes by, I realize how much more there is to do.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just two factors in the police reform, last thing we'll talk about in this topic, the commissioner of public safety idea and the power, I will say, that the unions have in contracts. How do those things, you know, coming from different angles, impact the ability to make lasting reform?
Yeah, well, you know, the police union at times they can be a very good partner, and at times they can be an obstacle. And I've experienced both. But as long as it's in place, then that's something that you have to navigate. And you know, the contract negotiation is a good example. You know, we negotiated a contract with the PBA. Back in 2019, that was ultimately voted down in 2020, and there was, you know, a lot of criticism about things that that weren't in there. And I try to remind people that it's a negotiation.
Right.
We're only going to get to the end if both sides can agree. So that is a factor, and that does it sometimes limit our options. But that's the reality of what we're dealing with. In terms of any type of public safety commissioner, you know, I think. It really has to do with style and what you're looking for in leadership in the department. Chief Buckner is a lifelong police officer, but that's not why he's in that position to be a cop. He's there to be an executive, and that's what he's being. And so whether he's a chief or a commissioner, I think it's what do you want out of the leadership of your department. And I don't think that there's anything that a different type of position, a commissioner position, could do that Chief Buckner can't and isn't already doing that isn't leading to positive change and reform.
So, Mayor, to wrap up here a little bit, what, by the end of 2021, do you hope to see in Syracuse? What do you want to get accomplished? What do you want the city to look like differently? What is your big, big vision overall?
Well, the vision that we established early on in the administration is for Syracuse to be a growing city that embraces diversity and creates opportunity for all. And over the course of the past 3 years, we've advanced a number of projects and initiatives and planted a lot of seeds to help advance that vision. And we've talked about some of those things, some of that growth, whether it's JMA or the Sault City Market. The Sault City Market is a great example of our vision kind of embodied, because you have growth in a new building. We're embracing the diversity of our community and the 10 small businesses from representing cultures all around the world being there, creating opportunity for all, the apartments upstairs being affordable and mixed income apartments. So by the end of this year, I just want to continue to see the seeds that we've planted grow, and I think we are going to see that. I'm really excited about the work that we're going to be doing in our neighborhoods, building new houses, new affordable houses, working on other quality of life issues. I want to continue to see a number of those other projects advance. Again, get started with the STEAM school. I had been asked about my state of the city, and some had wondered why I didn't have more, you know, big new announcements. And I think it's just as important to get those big announcements completed before you start announcing other ones. And so there's a lot of work that I think that you're going to see that we've, again, started over the past 3 years that we're going to be able to get done in 2021. So really, this year is about getting things done and then thinking about what's next.
All right, Mary Ben Walsh, thank you for joining us on Syracuse Speaks.
Happy to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up, the city's trying to make progress on a number of fronts while still fighting the weight of the pandemic. Still, those working on economic development, advancing smart city gains, and police reform say they're optimistic they can create positive momentum. That's up next on Syracuse Speaks, so keep listening.
At WAER, we keenly recognize the impact that COVID-19 is having on businesses and organizations throughout our community. As a listener, you know that WAER provides reliable coverage of local, regional, and world news every day. You also know that our loyal audience comprises of people just like you, educated, informed, and community-minded. WAER is here to help you get the word out about your business. Learn how you can reach our listeners at waer.org/sponsorship.
Syracuse will be a growing city that embraces diversity and creates opportunity for all. These are the values on which our city has been built and that continue to guide us every day.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks from 88.3 WAER. Coming up a little later, people from around the community look forward on what they hope for or expect out of 2021, reflecting on the turmoil of 2020 wrought on our health, the economy, and society. We'll hear from leaders of the business community and those who work with new Americans and senior communities.
We just heard Mayor Walsh discuss ways he's trying to move the city forward in 2021 as Syracuse swims against the currents of the pandemic and its broad impacts. Much of the work on improving city services, trying to move forward on economic agenda ideas, and police reform comes down to the people whose job it is to carry out those details.
We're joined by Nicholas Diaz, Syracuse's Chief Innovation and Data Officer, Jen Tift, who leads the city's Smart City Strategy and Syracuse Surge, and Jimmy Oliver, the city's first Director of Community Engagement in the Police Department. Right. And before we get into more specific details on some of the things that each of you work on, I just wanted to ask, how are you personally looking forward on 2021 while kind of, again, swimming upstream against the effects of the pandemic, you know, in terms of resources at work, your work situations, even people's moods and energy levels in your office?
You know, I'm really optimistic about 2021. We have a new administration in Washington, D.C. that gives us a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of encouragement. It's, you know, building relationships, you know, starting there, getting to know people, meeting people where they are, being an active listener, and, you know, trying to put yourself in those individuals' shoes and understand how we can find solutions to their concerns. A lot of people are very interested and intrigued about what we're going to do and how we're going to implement what we're going to do. And we're just excited to go out and talk about those things. So it's been good.
All right, great. Thanks. Nico?
Yeah, to be honest, it's still a little bit tough. We're still feeling the effects of the pandemic, obviously, and, you know, like, cabin fever does start to set in, and like, so it's been tough to keep up the morale, keep up the good work while acknowledging, you know, like, things are still difficult. The numbers seem to be improving. Yeah, we're really hopeful that we will go through this last part of the pandemic, as the new administration says, just like build back better, like take a lot of the process improvements that actually took place during the pandemic and sort of like continue building from there.
Yeah, maybe capitalize on some things that we've figured out how to do. Yeah,
exactly.
Jen, how are you looking forward, or how are you keeping going?
I would echo a lot of what Jimmy and Nico said. You know, I think we maybe in municipal government tend to be optimistic people by nature. So, you know, so our team over here at Neighborhood and Business Development, I think, has remained pretty optimistic even in the face of all of the challenges. You know, our department, you know, really tends to be pretty hands-on in the community, whether it's interfacing with, you know, residents in the neighborhoods or interfacing with businesses. And it's been hard, honestly, you know, to kind of watch them go through, frankly, what they've had to go through and not really be able to connect with them in some of the more personal ways that we would like to. I mean, I think for 2021, I'm really hopeful and optimistic to both maybe get past the pandemic a little bit, where we can start to interface a little bit more hands-on. But also, I think we've got some really, you know, exciting opportunities ahead to try to improve the connectivity and the digital access for people and for business owners as well. And so hopefully, even if the pandemic does require us to stay socially distanced for a while longer, you know, we'll be able to put in place much better infrastructure that enables us to all, you know, hopefully connect and meet people where they're at.
So I hear the word hope in all three of you. And, you know, I'm sure that that encompasses what lots of people are feeling, like hope that trends that seem to be going downward continue so we can move on to whatever that next thing is. Nico Diaz, let me come back to you for just a moment. What are some of the projects you're working on in innovation that can move forward and improve areas of the city and help its residents?
Yeah, so for a little bit of context, I head the Office of Accountability, Performance, and Innovation. And our team mandate is to look at the services that your city government is offering and make them more efficient, more effective and more equitable. So you really cannot improve processes if you don't know how well you're doing in the first place. Often we have a lot of data that sits unused in silos, so either in Excel spreadsheets or in antiquated servers. So to that end, we're working with Microsoft and Syracuse University to build our data warehouse this year, where we can actually connect different data points for much easier access and meaningful analysis. You may not be surprised also to learn that a lot of what we do is very paper-based, which is particularly clunky and inefficient in times of COVID, right? So we recently finished helping the finance department digitize its travel request process. Now we're doing the same thing for the personnel department as how they do certain employment vacancy processes. So I know that fixing these inefficient processes may not directly be seen by the constituents, but silently they cost the city a lot of money in terms of staff time. And so this year, Mayor Walsh's big challenge for us has been to put an emphasis on quality of life and how city services impact that. So one big project that we have going on there is to see how we can reduce illegal set outs in the city, accumulation of trash or debris or other materials in the right of way. We're actually testing how different messaging pamphlets can or cannot reduce those type of behaviors.
Jimmy Oliver, it's been a couple of months only. How are you settling in at the police department in your role as, you know, community relations?
I'm settling in pretty well. The department has been, open to me. You know, the police department has been doing a lot of work on engaging the community. And just letting them know that I'm another resource that they can use. I've had the pleasure of doing ride-alongs with officers, explaining what my role is, and, you know, the community as well, meeting with a lot of clergy, meeting with a lot of nonprofit organizations, meeting with a lot of community members. And, to the officers' credit, they're open.
What kind of things have you learned on a ride along? Or, I mean, you already had community connections coming from the Parks Department.
One of the things I would say is my first ride along was last Friday. And we were on the south side, had an interaction with some folks that got pulled over, had some really good conversations with the mom and an aunt about who I was, what I do, and why I'm there. Of course, they thought I was a police officer. And I told them that I wasn't, and I'm here to learn and observe. But then we, got on a nice little chase on the west side where I grew up, ran into some former, baseball players. And hearing officers communicate back and forth with the folks that they pulled over. And then they turned over their shoulder and they saw me. And they said, "Oh, hey, Jimmy, how you doing?" And I said, "Oh, you know, I'm doing fine. You know, I'm just here, you know, doing a ride along." Again, I think it makes them feel comfortable that they know someone who is at the police department, who grew up and spent quite a bit of time. And so I think that's what they want. They want to have some type of positive interaction to find out that they're real people. One of my mottos is, we think we're so different, but once we sit down and have conversations with each other, we find out that we have some type of connection.
Gotcha. Jen, certainly Syracuse Surge is a key initiative of the administration. I mean, we did just have the opening of the Salt City Market. What other kinds of progress or momentum might you see given the times we're in, and maybe it's a little harder to push things forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. Frankly, one of the things that I've been really, pleased about is how much progress and momentum we've been able to keep around some of our Syracuse Surge initiatives throughout the pandemic. We were fortunate in having some projects approved and to some degree funded before the pandemic hit. So we've been able to keep those things going. We are expecting to, you know, break ground on the STEAM school at the former Central Tech High School facility this year. The Tech Garden expansion will happen starting this year. You know, we finished the conversion of our streetlight network. The connected network that those lights sit upon actually create some of the pipes, if you will, for which, you know, the data can flow, for a lot of the projects that Nico and his team are going to be leading. And then I think there have been a couple of areas where under other circumstances, we would have probably seen a couple more surge-related projects being put forward as part of the Upstate Revitalization Initiative. But all in all, I think we're still surging, which is the good news.
I mean, some things are moving inexorably forward, like 5G is coming, and
right.
There's some energy behind investing in startup businesses still. Can the area capitalize on some of those things, even some of the attention it's gotten as a smart city?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and one of the big areas where I think, you know, a lot more people will have some very tangible opportunity is really around some of the workforce development related initiatives that we are undertaking as a part of Surge to really give, you know, residents of the city of Syracuse opportunities to get, you know, skilled in some of the emerging, you know, technology areas, you know, engaging both the tech employers in our community to identify, you know, either job openings or areas within their company that they think are going to be really key for more opportunities in the future. And then working with organizations like CNY Work that actually do, you know, kind of more hands-on training and trying to get people, you know, who have an aptitude or just an interest even in some of these technologies to get them, you know, ready for those jobs.
Jimmy, let me just come back to you once real quickly because the mayor actually released a reform agenda for police. Where do you see your work in community relations fitting in with that larger purpose of police reform?
First, I would say that engagement piece, again, meeting people where they are, being able to get information and explain it to the community in layman terms. If it's use of force, how do we navigate those? How do we make sure that those things don't happen? But one of the things that I think will be very helpful is our PAL program, our Police Athletics League that we will be kicking off in October 2021. Put young people and police in the same space around sports. Sports being the carrot to get the young people in the door, or we can talk about job opportunities, we can talk about scholarship, we can talk about mentorship. And if we're able to connect the police officer, a probation, the district attorneys, our partners at the Boys and Girls Club, our partners at Parks and Recreation, we will be able to sustain or grow our high school graduation rate. The community talks about, we want officers who look like us, Black and brown folks who understand what it takes to be a police officer. And, you know, these programs have been around for 100 years, 50 years, and they have grown police officers. And that's what we want to do.
You see that kind of thing, which on one hand doesn't really look like police reform, but impacting some of those other problems that emerge when there's a conflict and it grows out of proportion, probably from a lot of misunderstanding or bias or prejudice. So these kinds of things can start to chip away at those cultural things, which are at the center of a lot of the police reform.
Yes. And I think, too, you know, there's a lot of different nationalities here in the city of Syracuse. We're working on a program where we're going to identify three community stakeholders, say they speak Bosnian. And a person who's Bosnian gets pulled over, come and translate, help the officer understand, help the resident understand, so that we can, you know, move in a positive direction. Because I think a lot of times people don't know what they don't know. And if we're not, again, willing to meet them where they are, it creates conflict. And, you know, we at the police department are trying to find different strategies and models from across the country that are going to help us move Syracuse to a place where we can have those better connections.
Great. I think I need to wrap it up there. Thank you all for your comments. Thanks for joining us on Syracuse Speaks. Good luck to all of you in your various arenas. And, you know, hopefully you can all continue to make progress in them in 2021. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Coming up, we ask community leaders, what is your vision for Syracuse in 2021? Answers from Greater Syracuse Hope, Interfaith Works, and Center State CEO are next. Stay with us.
It is only through listening that we can truly understand. and through seeing and feeling that we strengthen the motivation and urgency to act.
From Clinton Square to Central Square, WAER News is dedicated to keeping you up to date with news happening in the places you call home.
Onondaga County is entering week 4 of its COVID-19 vaccine distribution efforts and plans to vaccinate 5 to 6,000 people this week.
An upstate New York conservation group has purchased hundreds of acres of land that will protect some of the Finger Lakes from pollution and ultimately protect our drinking water.
Find continued local news coverage at WAER.org.
And we're attracting attention and investment from some of the world's most respected companies. That attraction is being fueled by two things: the way in which we are working together as a community, and just as important, our strategy that puts opportunity for all as our highest priority.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. We're talking about what's in store for Syracuse in the coming year. I'm Chris Bolt.
And I'm Katie Zolkowski. City government is not the only one with new goals for this new year. Leaders of Syracuse's nonprofits, arts institutions, and community organizations are looking to the future while still battling the pandemic and its consequences. We reached out to a number of local agencies to see what they're looking forward to and hoping for in the new year. Here's what they had to say.
This is Rob Simpson, president of Center State CEO. I think the thing that I'm looking forward to the most about 2021 is having the opportunity to get back and do some of the strategic work that was moving this community forward before the pandemic hit in early 2020. Syracuse and Central New York were on a remarkable economic roll. We were seeing people moving to our region from outside of Central New York for the first time in 3 or 4 decades. We're seeing our highest level of economic growth, job growth, and economic performance for the first time in 4 or 5 decades. We had a lot of enthusiasm that was built, a community leadership that was working together. And while those things have certainly remained true, that our community's been working together well over the course of the last year, there's no doubt that some of those more exciting initiatives have slowed down or been put on hold. So my hope for 2021 is that we can get through this necessary phase where people are getting vaccinated. I'm hoping that we can return to some level of normalcy during the course of the year, and that at some point before the end of this calendar year, we have the ability to take many of these big visionary projects that we've been talking about for a long time. The STEAM school in downtown Syracuse, the redevelopment of Interstate 81, the redevelopment of the Tech Garden and the expansion of that facility to serve our region's entrepreneurs, get these projects in the ground as quickly as possible, get people back to work, continue to make progress on the massive racial and socioeconomic disparities that we know exist not only here in Syracuse but across the country, and go into the end of this year with a sense of accomplishment that we're back on the track that we had been on just 12 short months ago.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Dunbar, the director and CEO of the Everson Museum of Art in downtown Syracuse. In 2021, I'm excited about a lot of things. I'm really looking forward to hosting all of our members, patrons, supporters, visitors back in the museum's building, our I Am Pay Treasure, to see all of our new exhibitions, to see some of the improvements we've made to our space, and to show off some things that might be a surprise, including our new cafe and an outdoor seating area overlooking the plaza. I'm really looking forward to visiting with folks I've only been able to see on Zoom meetings. One of the things I've missed the most in the last year is being able to get together with our patrons, our members, our supporters, artists in the community, our volunteers, and to talk about art and just get together and hang out. It's been fun to participate in social activities online, but there's nothing better than getting together as a group and enjoying art and conversation together.
Hi, I'm Bob Hupp, Artistic Director of Syracuse Stage. What I'm really looking forward to in 2021 is that time when we can all once again gather together and have common experiences, shared experiences like a cultural event. For me, I'm looking forward to getting to a baseball game or just being able to gather in groups at restaurants and other activities that make Syracuse special. And so for me, it's about this opportunity to come together. And particularly here at Syracuse Stage, the opportunity to once again welcome our community back into our theater, to have those once-in-a-lifetime opportunities to see plays and musicals and just get to know people all over again. Of course, as we move forward into 2021, at those times when we can get back together, I'm also looking forward to continuing our conversations about how we can make Syracuse a more just and equitable community. Those kind of face-to-face conversations with our neighbors, with our community, is vital to the ongoing efforts that we have to commit to as we move forward.
I am Nicole Watts, founder and CEO of Hope Print, a Syracuse-born organization which seeks to unify diverse communities rich in culture and connectedness to prosper in place. And what I'm excited about for 2021 are some new initiatives that our organization is working with alongside of other entities and most especially the neighborhood residents who we call neighbors and friends to co-build a neighborhood plan together of development and what it might really look like for us to prosper in place. Also excited to get started on some of that work with redeveloping some local residential houses and fostering homeownership by current residents who have been living the tenant renter life, being able to begin building important household equity through that thing that we all dream about and making it a genuine, equitably accessible thing for all of the folks who call our neighborhood home, as well as coming alongside of the neighborhood businesses that also call this neighborhood home to maybe breathe some fresh life after the difficult year that they have had and come up with creative ways that they might be viable, long-lasting, wonderful stakeholding elements of our community. And looking at transit and the way that transit plays such a key role in our connection to each other in neighborhood as well as outside of the neighborhood, and the impact that that has on employment opportunities and just our overall life and viability economically and socially in the community. We believe that as we come at all these things together with our diversely beautiful community coming together to dream and to imagine what's possible, that 2021 is going to be a game changer in the most beautiful of ways. And so I cannot wait to watch all the ways that that comes true this year.
My name is Joseph E. O'Hara. I'm the executive director of Peace Incorporated. And during 2020, we're looking forward to completing the comeback from the 100-year pandemic and continuing to help the children, families, and seniors we serve at Peace on their journey to self-sufficiency. We think 2021 is going to be the best year yet, and we're looking forward to working together with the city. Hope everybody has a great year.
So my name is John Cimino. I am the co-founder and director of In My Father's Kitchen, which is an organization that does direct street outreach to the chronically homeless of Central New York. And I have a great expectation for 2021 for Syracuse and Central New York. And working with the chronically homeless in Central New York, the challenge has been through this pandemic, through 2020 and now entering 2021, it's been the challenge of getting folks into secure and stable housing. A lot of the housing providers' programs kind of have frozen up. So people have been on this waiting list trying to get into housing. And I'm really looking forward to, as these vaccines and things start to come out and these providers in our community can start to do face-to-face encounters again with individuals that we can present to the homeless coalition, that these housing opportunities start to open back up again for people to get into safe, stable housing. And then the other thing that I'm expecting for this wonderful year coming forward in 2021 is we have a higher ground day labor program that is contracted with the county through the city of Syracuse. And we had to scale back on our participants on our van to make sure that we're safe and social distancing. And also we had to stop a kind of a program that was built to get people from panhandling to our van into kind of employment. All that got shut down. During COVID, we had our first cohort ready to go through a program, getting them ready to get ready for employment opportunities, and that had to shut down. So I'm expecting that in 2021, that we start to turn this corner and that we're going to be able to get people who are on the streets into viable jobs so they can become viable again in our community. So those are my two great expectations, our hope for 2021.
My name is Osha Keaton, and I am the Executive Director of Greater Syracuse Hope. Syracuse is a place of pride. We pride ourselves on the ability to endure the weather, endure adverse conditions, and endure preconceived notions about the place we call home. My vision for Syracuse is that the city actually begins to persevere by rebuilding. We can start to rebuild by centering projects on people and restructuring the power dynamics to include everyday residents. This is the quickest way to move forward, uplifting and empowering the people, because at the core, they are what matters most.
My name is Beth Broadway. I'm the president and CEO at Interfaith Works here in Syracuse. And my hope and vision for 2021 is that our world, our nation, and this community will set a course for racial equity like never before, and that this course will heal the deep wound of racism that continues to plague us. I hope that our hearts as humans will open as never before to each other across all our differences, and that we will seek out friendships and build relationships and bridges across our social, religious, and economic divides. I hope we will recognize that we are truly connected to each other, and that we will turn our thoughts, our actions, and indeed our very lives to the task of creating beloved community among us. My hope and vision for 2021 include a recommitment to welcoming refugees and immigrants who come here to start their lives over after fleeing the terror of war and famine. I also hope for peace and comfort for all who have suffered from COVID, whether personally or as a family member of someone who has died or become disabled in this tragic pandemic. And I hope that all of our elders who face loneliness and despair would find joy and friendship and dignity. And finally, I hope that our nation will recommit itself to addressing the pressing needs of the climate crisis, and that each of us would do our part to save this beautiful earth. My vision is that we will work together for liberty and for justice and equality for all.
The coming year will require a lot of work to remedy the harm caused by COVID-19 and advance Syracuse in an equitable and just way. But we'll continue to hold space for these conversations here on Syracuse Speaks as we all make our way through 2021 together.
Syracuse Speaks is a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media, with support from the St. Mary Ann Cope Shrine and Museum's Empathy in Action Initiative. Our executive producer is Joe Lee, and today's show was produced by Kevin Claus. You can listen to today's show or past Syracuse Speaks programs at waer.org. For Katie Zilkowski, I'm Chris Bolt. Thanks for listening.